Hi, I'm Gary Barkalow, founder of The Noble Heart and author of It's Your Call. I'm excited to offer this resource that has been years in the making. 5 years ago, we created an online community for those who have attended a Noble Heart retreat or have taken the online calling course. For men, this community is called Base Camp. For women, it's The Secret Garden. One of the things that we offer to these communities are weekly live interactive conversations with members and guests. Now, after having done hundreds of these recorded conversations, we are creating a series of the Best of Campfire Conversations, a collection of the quintessential ideas, insights, and perspectives of our guests. I hope these interview clips help you live more alert and oriented as you walk with God, guard your heart, and offer the weightiness of your life to the world. Our first guest in part two of Reorienting Your Heart is Paul Stanley. Paul was a senior executive with the Navigators. He started Leadership Development Network and has co-authored the book, Connecting, The Mentoring Relationships You Need to Succeed. Paul and his wife, Phyllis, mentored Lee and I for many years.
Well, I was 41 and I just came back from being 13 years over in Europe, and I joined as a co-lead the U.S. Navigators, and we heard about this guy, Bobby Clinton, out in School of World of Missions there at Fuller, and he was the one and only professor of leadership. We connected with him. He had a nav background when he was younger. So you all have had this experience where someone is talking about something that you feel very interested in. You're very eager to hear more, but the guy is saying things that you feel exactly. And he's giving words to your thoughts you never had words for. And, well, that was the way it was with Bobby Clinton. He had spent, you know, a couple decades already studying the subject of leader development in the scriptures and all through the different characters and key leaders in the scriptures. And so he had tremendous insights, but he was giving me words. And I was sitting there copying things down. It was a two-week intensive graduate-level course, and so I was just writing furiously. And about the second day, he came over to me. There were 30 mid-career people, which is a great kind of environment there, because they bring experiences into almost everything he brings up. And he was great at pulling that out from people. But he came over to me and he said, "What in the world are you writing down every word I'm saying?" And I said, "No, I'm frantic trying to write these thoughts down. I'm just so excited about this." And so we got time together, and that started a relationship and began to help me understand about intentional leader development. Much of leader development takes place when you are, you know, doing different things and different responsibilities you have and all the rest. But there's also some intentionality is place people in situations that will challenge them. But the failure of many is we put people in responsibility and say, "Good luck, let me know if you need some help." And then we don't intentionally keep connecting with the person, not to peek over his shoulder, but to keep talking about issues, keep talking about what he's doing and what's going on. So I began to hear these things and look at my experiences, and that really led me to a number of things. But one of the books that I read that actually led me to the authors was Kuzis and Posnan, who wrote The Leadership Challenge. And when that came out in its first edition, it's become quite a system now. But just in the early days, there was something in there they said, and they footnoted a study or a research. And I went back to them, got a hold of them and talked to them about this. And it turned out that it was a study of close to 3,000 executives, middle-level managers and executives, on the whole subject of where did you get your most development as a leader. So with 3,000, it was an excellent, you know, full group to do this with, and so the results were quite valid. And they put them in four categories, and you can apply this to not just leaders, but, you know, people. Different responsibilities, but the first one was responsibilities, because it's in the context of carrying out responsibility you learn the most. So in the harness of responsibility, you learn the most. you're pulling, you have questions, you meet things you're not sure of, you just have to ask somebody. It's a builder. And the second one was relationships, everything from mentors and models and peer friends and short-term people who come into your life. And then the third one was the significant experiences, and they could be good or bad, but they were very shaping in their impact. Then the fourth one was training, both formal training, colleges and that, and then non-formal, which was seminars and that, and then informal, which is on-the-job training. And well, what really caught my attention was they went in to verify these four to about 150 leaders who have retired, have finished their years of leading, and asked them if they agreed with these four, and there was agreement right across the line as general categories, but then asked them this, that if you were to put percentages on it, now looking back over a lifetime, you know, what percentages would you ascribe to each of those four? I was just amazed by it, but it was made sense. The order I just gave is the order they wound up being, but the responsibilities was 50%. 50% of their learning about leadership and learning in life, most from in the context of carrying out their responsibilities. And then the second one was relationships, and that was 30%. So here's the top two, already 80%. And then the third and the fourth were 10% each. And what was amazing is that the leader development that I knew, at least from an organizations and other types, it was mainly the fourth level of training. We go get a master's, we'd go do something, we'd look in that direction. But that's really over a lifetime, perhaps provided about 10% of your growth impetus.
What have you found are the keys to life change?
Well, unfortunately, the agent of the greatest immediate change is crisis. And that's not something that we can necessarily manipulate or introduce at will. When a person has been in a crisis situation and she is at the very brink of breaking into some deeper, great issues. I've watched it happen. I've watched it happen in the Bible, as you know, Jesus challenged different ones, you know, you to leave all and let the dead bury the dead, just come with me, you know, tough decisions they have to make. And then, you know, crisis situations that you get into, that that's where a good friend, a good mentor can come along and perceive some of that, or a leader who's this one of his younger persons. A crisis will make him wide open to change. It's a teaching moment. It's a moment to sometimes give grace. It's sometimes to give truth. That happens, and that's why it's important in the development of people, our own development, to be very aware of that. And you can go into deeper situations because people can change. Like, for instance, one time I was struggling with an issue and my own life, and things just seemed to be going wrong, my wife and I were, you know, there was some tension there, and other things were happening. And so I came to my spiritual mentor, and he was a couple decades older, and he was the president of our organization, and just a godly guy. And so I came and I said, just so many things are going wrong. And he said, well, Paul, it's either one or two things. And he said, either it's the experience of John 15, where Jesus is pruning. He's pruning you. He's cutting branches off, and they hurt when they get cut off. And so, but what's the result of, you know, why is he cutting and pruning those branches? I said, well, for more fruit. And he says, yeah. He says, well, do you want that? And I said, yes. He says, well, that's the way it'll come. You just keep, you know, responding and embracing into that situation, and you know, if it's the pruning. But he said, the pruning, you don't have the controls to stop it or start it. It's God. It's totally in his hands. It's in the in the master's hands to cut. He knows when and where and how and which ones. So we had an excellent conversation and on that, and he suggested I just take some time to pray and over those things. And then I came back to him in 2 weeks, and I said, "You said there were two. What's the other one?" And he said, "Well, that's the Hebrews 12, 7 and following." And he says there, he says, to take all difficulties as something God is bringing to you as a discipline. And why is he disciplining you? So you read a little further, and it says that you might be more righteous. He says, "Do you want that?" And I said, "Yes, I long for that." He said, "Well, then embrace it. Embrace it." And so then he taught me how to, you know, embrace these ideas and to write and a journal and start journaling more, and gave me a couple books on this. And the most powerful book was The Life on Mueller, George
okay.
Mueller. Yeah. And his godly life and what he asked me to do, I learned from him. He said, "Don't ever give a book for somebody to read and just said, read this." But he gave me three questions. And he said, "As you read this, Paul, note the spirituality he approaches to each situation and how that grew." The second one was, he said, "Every decision he made, look at the factors and how he went through that decision." And then he gave me a fourth one in terms of responding. How did he respond to disappointment? And so anyhow, when I finished that book, oh, it was such a powerful book for me. Well, then he and I went through that because he did the same thing. We shared and shared. It took us three different two-hour meetings to just talk that through. And it's very, very deep and very precious and timely. And he helped bring that little finger into to help me point things out that could be. He didn't accuse me of anything. But the interesting thing was, is I was not in a crisis in my career at all. But what I was in a crisis is internally. Dealing with some of the things that were happening that were not that I had planned for. It came out some other way, or conflicts with some people that I couldn't figure out why the conflict, and just other things, and then the tension between my wife and I, and so when I pulled back, he stayed with me. That's the important point. He stayed with me the whole time.
Our next guest is Mark Weaver, a Basecamp member and a longtime friend. Mark has a commercial real estate business that covers Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. He and his wife, Mary Jean, have been very involved in people's lives for many years. It's who they are.
Mark made a pretty drastic change in his life, in the way he lives, in the way he relates to people, in the way he does his schedule. And I remember hearing about it and then reading an email that he sent to his friends. And it really struck me as his seriousness of the way he lives and therefore how that reflects on his walk with God, on the depth of his relationships with his children and his wife and his friends. And Mark, I'd love for you to go back to, first of all, what brought about this change that you made, and therefore then go into the change with us.
So you got this situation, kind of this friction going on, where Mary Jean and I are trying to go deep with the Lord and live in a place of beauty. And at the same time, we're living life. She's working. My wife's a pharmacist. She's working, and I'm working, and we got kids, and we got all the activities that surround them. We're real involved with our church fellowship up here in Woodland Park. I'm pretty active in that and serving some leadership roles there. And we've got both got family still back in Texas. So do you get the picture? There's a lot going on. We're having to go back to Texas fairly often, me for business. So there's this pretty fast pace, a lot of demands, a lot of relational demands on us. And this rocks along for several years, and it takes a toll on my heart and Mary Jean's heart. And what really started to form up in, last year, is I had to go to Texas for about 15 weeks of the year last year. So I'm gone away from the house. Mary Jean's got the kids and trying to wrangle them and keep it all going. And at the same time, I'm trying to stay active in my fellowship, the church fellowship here, and there's just a ton of activity going on. By the end of last year, y'all, I was just exhausted. I was physically tired. I was emotionally drained, sapped. Mary Jean and I were kind of at that place where we're like, okay, what do we got to do to get through this next day? Where do we need to take the kids, and what do we need to do, and who do we need to see, and who do we need to call? All those sort of things are still going on. And it just wore us down. And we started to get this feeling that, you know, I can't do this another year. I can't have this kind of pace and rhythm for another year. We just won't make it. Our marriage won't make it. I'll continue to just be mad and angry. That's a kind of the side symptom of this, is you're exhausted and mad a lot because you don't feel like you have any say in this swift current that you're in. You just are taken away by it. So all that's going on. So I went to a retreat that was about some Benedictine rules of lifestyle and living. That was very helpful. And it was essentially a lot of prayer, a lot of scripture reading, a lot of community life around meals, preparation of meals and eating the meals, and then community way of doing work around the monastery. And what it develops is this steady, sustainable rhythm. It's not complicated, so it's a simple thing to do, and what it does is it kind of moves out the clutter of stuff that doesn't need to go on in the day for these monks. So they establish this rhythm and way of moving through their days. And this retreat was us taking a look at that and actually practicing it for, I think it was a 5-day retreat. And it was life-giving. And it was very different, of course, from what our hectic life was like. And so out of that came this almost urgency in me that I've got to implement some changes. And talking over with Mary Jean, look, let's really do some changes, or we're just, the pain of it is going to kill us, and we're not going to make it another 6 months. So that's what we did, Gary, is we came out of that and said, okay, what's the most important things to us for real? And what gives life to us, and what drains life from us? And so we took about a month and a half and just let those questions kind of roll around in us, and we talk about them and that sort of thing, even engaging with the kids about this sort of thing. And out of those about 45 days, we came up with this kind of declaration of rhythm is what we called it. One of the things that we had to do is look at some of our obligations and commitments that we had been carrying on for years, and we had to disengage from some of them. And that's hard to do. You have to tell people no on stuff you've been doing and explain it and that sort of thing. So disengaging from too many commitments and obligations, and disengaging from the pace of getting with people and meeting with people. We had to slow that way down so that we could just replenish our own hearts. So let's put it down. Let's tell our friends, because we don't want to broadside them with, you know, if they keep asking us to do things and we say no, no, no. We want them to know why we're doing what we're doing. And so that's what prompted the letter that Gary's talking about we sent out in January.
So tell us basically what your declaration of rhythm was that you told people.
Well, what we were thinking on that letter is that we really wanted to invite people into our journey. And these are dear friends that were writing, and some of my family, and some of Mary Jean's family, and some of the people that we watch over and care for, that sort of thing. So they know our life and that sort of thing. And we wanted to just kind of let them in on the journey with us. We want them to let them know that, hey, we're struggling a little bit here. We're wobbling, and we don't want this to continue. So here's the changes we're going to make. And then the rest of the letter was just content about, okay, look, this is what we're going to do. And it was about the Sabbath, and it was about meals together, and it was about days to get with people, specific days for us to spend time with people. It was about our work. It was about our kids and how they're the priority. And so it would just got into the more specific things like that.
Yeah, why don't you give us some of the specifics?
Well, the first thing we started with is we told them that we were going to start doing a real Sabbath. This has been one of the hardest things to do to incorporate into our lifestyle. But it's also been the most wonderful thing. So we start out with that saying, look, from 6 p.m. Friday till 6 p.m. Saturday, we're on Sabbath. And that means I'm turning off my cell phone and I'm not checking my emails. I told them something to the effect of we were going to be unavailable for consultation. Something like that, and said, we're just going to spend time together as a family. We don't want to get legalistic about it, about what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
What we wanted was the heart behind it is to just simply rest and to stop doing what we normally do and to cease and celebrate. There's a lot of key words that we use to help just remind ourselves that this is a time set aside for us to be remembering the goodness of the Lord and remembering that we're all dependent on Him, that I don't need another day that I can catch up on things or do extra projects or run errands or anything. We absolutely stop and rest. Friday nights, we celebrate Shabbat, which is just simply we come together for the intent of marking that this is the start of the Sabbath for us. And we cook a meal, nothing complicated. It's usually like spaghetti and fresh bread or something like that. And we sit around, it's just us as a family, and we'll do the Shabbat meal. And we want to hear from the kids, what was their week like, what was the high, what was the low. And then we pray for them. We spend time going around to each child and just praying for them. And it surprised us in that how much they enjoy this prayer over the when we're praying for them. Usually the dinner table, around the dinner table, is kind of fun and joking and laughing and goofing around, right, at the dinner table. But yep. When we shift into this mode of praying for the kids, they all settle down. And it's just amazing to watch. They'll put their head on the table, and I'll just come over and I'll just pray for them. And I'm, you know, stroking their hair or rubbing their back or something like that. And I'm just speaking blessing over them and hope and destiny and all those sort of things. And they just settle into it. I think their hearts just really soak it up. Mm. And that's been unexpected. We thought it might be a little hard to, okay, now y'all calm down. We're going to pray for you. And if they'd roll their eyes and try to shoot out or something like that. But they really enjoy it. And so we do that, and that's our Friday night. And then we just go on Saturday mornings and go, what is it that we'd like to do that is absolutely fun, that would bring a smile to our face?
Our final guest for part two is Susie Larson. She hosts her own daily live talk show called Live the Promise. In fact, I met her as a guest on her show. She has written many books, some of which are Alone in Marriage, Balance That Works When Life Doesn't, Embracing Your Freedom, Your Beautiful Purpose, and The Uncommon Woman.
When you asked me, you know, if there's a direction I wanted to go in regard to talking about calling, the two things that come up for me a lot as a women's conference speaker traveling around, you know, one is the ambition. Because we live in a Western culture where there's much wealth, and even in Christianity, there's a lot of making a name for myself under the guise of Christianity, that really scares me, because for me, my calling evolved out of the ashes of my pain. I'm under no illusion why I get to do what I do, and it was because God rolled up his sleeve and pulled me out of the worst, desperate, most painful place in my life, and he put a new song in my heart. And so even those doors opened up, and I got published, and my speaking platform grew and got a radio show, all those things. I had, you know, people coming up going, how did you get this stuff to happen? And I would see the stars in their eyes And I would try to explain to them what it means to lean in and be refined and to abide in the vine. 99% of the people that start to hear that testimony walk away going, yeah, I just want to do what you do. I mean, I want the prize, but I don't want the process, you know. And so there's a real burden in my heart for people to know. I love what you say. In fact, I've quoted you so many times about that our call is so closely linked with that deep desire of our hearts. I mean, that just, to me, shows the love of God right there. And it was a relief for me to even hear you say that. It was so good for me. And I've carried that around. And yet I do believe that every person has that, as you say. But I think many abandon their call in that valley of refinement because they would rather come out with their flesh intact than their dream intact. And there's something of us that has to die to our rights, our need to be noticed, our personal ambitions, for God's dream to really live in us. And it's not an easy process, but it is so worth it on the other side.
Oh, that's so good. And so how would you differentiate, how would you explain the difference between, let's say, selfish ambition, Scripture talks about, and ambition, just the desire to develop something to its fullest in your life so you could offer to others versus selfish ambition?
Well, I think symptoms of self-ambition are envy, pride, jealousy, competition, comparison. Now let me hear me right about the competition piece. I am an athlete at heart, even though I'm in my late 40s. If I get on a bike ride with my husband, I'm out to win, even if it's a fun ride. You know what I mean? I have that in me, okay?
Uh-huh.
But I'm talking about looking at other ministries as the competition, about peering over their shoulder and being jealous of the way God is using them. That is all about us. Now there still might be something in us that I want to be someone whose ministry he expands. But those things, when they come onto the Lordship of Jesus Christ, and you do that, you go through the refining place that he brings every one of us through, suddenly the goal is that needs get met, whether it's through me, whether it's through you. There's plenty of work out there. Jesus says, pray that you'd raise up, that I would raise up laborers for the harvest because the workers are so few and the need is so great. And so when the focus shifts where it's like, I get to be a part of the bigger voice, I get to be a part of the bigger story, but I'm just one voice. You know,
yeah.
This isn't about me building my kingdom. It's advancing his kingdom. And I think that those are the two differences. And I think every one of us, because we have a dream in our heart and a tendency towards our flesh, to put our weight into our flesh, will have that. I mean, it's going to be mixed up. And for me, it was a major refining period of a valley time where first God put the dream in my heart. Then he let me have a little bit of a taste of it to see that this is something I could do. This is sort of a sweet spot for me. And then all the opportunities sort of dried up, and I went into this valley of preparation, and I watched everybody else, you know, gleefully skip off into their callings, and it brought up all my stuff, and that was so good, because the Lord was, like, showing me this is the stuff. And he showed me, though, in his love, Gary, that I only want to extract this from you, the very things that the enemy would want to use against you. If I leave this intact, all your self stuff, and let you go on and do the things I want to do through you, those will be access points for the enemy. He will be able to hook you. He will be able to bait you. And so this is my love, extracting this stuff from you so as much as possible you can walk this out with a pure heart. And so for me, I once started to embrace and lean into that process, I never wanted to leave that place. I was like, I don't care if I do anything except live in your presence. And that's what he was after, was this intimate love affair. And so, you know, I basically came out of that valley leaning on the arms of my beloved, as it says, and I think in Hosea. And from that point, now I have to tell you, I just don't deal with status as far as when I see people of status, it does nothing. It doesn't even affect me, and it's like dead to me, because when I esteem highly, it's that humble, God-fearing servant. If I meet someone like that, which I see that in you, Gary, then I'm like, you know, I'm a like-minded person with that person, and I can see the gift of God in them. But for, you know, I might say, I have to be honest, you know, there might be times when I start to get some momentum, I'm tempted to look down and become self-aware, but it really is more like a black dot on a big white screen that rather than a whole picture of
right.
myself. Do you know what
right.
I'm saying?
Oh, so I do. Yep. Okay, so Susan, let me ask you a question. If God says that his strength is perfected in our weakness, and yet it seems like in our calling, we're bringing this strength that God has given us to others, how do you reconcile those?
That's a fabulous question, first of all. And the first thought that comes to my mind, my pastor has this diagram that I use often, and I think I might have used it on our show together when we were on with you. But if you picture a circle, and inside the circle is the known zone, and that's your comfort zone. And, you know, we're kings and queens of our comfort zones. We're a big deal in there because we know our way around. Then you add another circle around that circle, and that's the learning zone. And you step out of your comfort zone to learn. Suddenly you're off balance. And so let's say you're a corporate giant, but you hit going to the mission field and suddenly you're not such a big deal. Or maybe you're, you know, a literary genius, but you go into an aerobic class and you suddenly see, well, I'm not such a big deal here. You know what I'm saying? And so we go into that learning zone and you're a little off balance. And then, but the thing is, if you stay and accommodate your comforts and your fears and your strengths even in the known zone actually shrinks. And that's just biblically and scientifically proven. If you accommodate where you're comfortable and only live there, even what you know, you lose. But if you step out into that learning zone and subject yourself to that learning and trusting God and letting yourself be put in positions where, you know, he must increase, you know, suddenly, eventually that learning zone becomes more of your known zone and your known zone increases. Well, the next circle is the faith zone, and we cannot please him without faith. And I think when we are living in faith, because we can't please him without faith, I think we live so far beneath our means, spiritually speaking. But when we step out into those places, we are weak. And so he will use our strengths to glorify his name. But I think that if we just camp on our strengths and coddle those things, and we are not willing to subject ourselves to stepping into places that maybe aren't comfortable for us, that we really are, you know, in over our heads, that is where, you know, my weakness is so real. And when something happens, I can only point to God. It's like, there's just no way this would happen if it wouldn't have been him. Nobody can do the math and say, yeah, I can see why that came out of her. And to me, I guess, my weaknesses are most exposed when I'm stepping out of my self-protection, my need to self-preserve, and following him to places where if he doesn't come through, I am done. And so that would be my long answer.
Do you find, as you do talk to people, whether it's on your radio show or just personally interacting or while you're traveling, do you find that there are certain kind of common, frequent fires that people have to go through? Would you say, well, I can name three things that probably everybody's going to go through because I've seen it, or not? Do you see a pattern there of what those
things? You know, well, in a brushing stroke, that's a really great question. I think in one thing that I just noticed that I've seen again and again is it's kind of like Joseph, where God will move in and speak and give you a taste of your call, and then he backs up, and it seems like, I thought we were dancing here. I open my eyes and you're gone. You know what I mean? Where, you know, it's like, and the opportunities sort of dry up, and there's a season where things pull back. The grace lifts, or not the grace lifts, but I mean the opportunities pull back. But you got the energy. You're ready to run. And he's like, all right, here. And that I've seen again and again. And it's like, what will you do with that? Do you trust him enough to wait on him? You know, and you look at, you know, Moses in the Old Testament, or Abraham and David, you know, these men knew how. I'm not moving without him. Can we do that? Do we have the self-restraint to do that or not? And again, living in this wonderful country, we have access to making almost anything happen if we want it. And you will have people who tell you you're naive if you're feeling called to wait, and they say, you know, if it's to be, it's up to me. So that would be one thing for sure. And betrayal from other people, that's another very big thing, is people misassigning your motives, misreading you, or they put you on a pedestal and they have stars in their eyes and they want to be, and then they get near you and realize, you know. But, I mean, they get disappointed in your humanity, and then they become your worst enemy and stab you in the back and gossip about you. That happened to me, and I've talked to many, many people who that's just been desperately painful. And then, you know, there's the health issues and those kinds of things that are just that create a dependence on God. But if your calling is really from the Lord, which it is, it's going to be about bettering the kingdom, advancing God's purposes, you know, helping the lives of others. And that is ground that will be opposed, you know. It's like we're not going to take ground and not have opposition. And so we've got to know how to contend with the things that contend with us. And there's times where humble yourself under the mighty hand. Other times rise up, put your shield up. We have to know how to do that. And so that is my passion, Gary, is just to see people entrust themselves in the refining place and learn how to stand, learn when to bow.
I hope that these conversations have spoken to your heart what was needed in this part of your journey. I'll notify you by email when the next part, the next release, is available. I encourage you to sign up for the Noble Heart updates if you haven't done so already.